Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the House passage of a record-high $733 billion defense bill, which both the Congress and the press are discussing in terms of how amendments by the Democrats are restricting Trump from waging war on Iran, while the Republicans decry the politicization of the National Defense Authorization Act. But there is no mention of how much money is being spent and whether we have any real enemies except for China and Russia, neither of whom want a hot war. William Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy and author of Profits of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, joins us to discuss our zombie defense budget that sucks up increasing amounts of the nation's treasure without any real debate about why and what for. Recently, the Iranians shot down a Global Hawk drone, which costs $123 million apiece, and nobody blinked an eye that the supposedly invulnerable stealth surveillance platform was detected by a Russian radar system that makes stealth technology redundant, and that a minor power was able to shoot the drone down. Meanwhile, the Pew Research Center reports published on Wednesday, finds that a majority of veterans who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan say that the cost and burden of the wars outweigh any successes, and that 64% feel that the Iraq war was not worth fighting, while 58% feel the same about America's longest war in Afghanistan. Then we'll speak with Lucian Truscott IV, a journalist and best-selling author who is a graduate of West Point and a regular columnist at Salon, where he has an article, Jeffrey Epstein is Donald Trump's idea of a perfect man. We will discuss how, while Trump's former accomplice Epstein is in jail, we have a sexual predator in the Oval Office, but put there by a minority of the American people. We'll speculate whether Trump's reality TV presidency of government by stunt has exhausted us, even though his act is getting tired. But nevertheless, no matter how contrived his antics are, like today's heavily telegraphed roundup of so-called illegals, it grabs the headlines. Then finally, we'll look into whether the delivery of a Russian missile system to Turkey, which the U.S. has warned is a deal-breaker in terms of Turkey's involvement with the F-35 program and possibly NATO itself. Ahmet Yalçın, a professor in the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University, who was chair of the sociology department at Turkey's Harran University and was a counterterrorism police chief in Turkey, joins us to discuss how Putin is driving a wedge between NATO's two biggest armies with the complicity of President Erdogan in spite of Turkey's historical animus towards Russia. Before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners who are helping us sustain and build Background Briefing online. We are grateful for the donations from across the nation and around the world coming in at backgroundbriefing.org/donate that keep us corporate free, fearless, and independent as we weaponize facts against authoritarian fictions to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is William Hartung, who's director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy? A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Profits of War, that's P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Bill. And why do you think it is that there's no, very little discussion, by the way, in the press in general about this new increase in defense spending from $716 billion to a record $733 billion when we don't have any real enemies? The Russia and China don't want a war, although, you know, Russia's perfectly happy to screw with the U.S. as it's doing incredibly successfully. And China is totally interlocked with the U.S. in our economy, and their economy are totally tied together. And they're the biggest holder of our treasury bills. So it doesn't really make any sense to go to war, although I'm sure there is still in both cases a possibility. And then we've got, you know, minor powers like Iran threatening to have a war with, and then 10 minutes before we started a war with Iran, the president backed away because he found out that the price of gas would go up and that would hurt him in terms of re-election. So why is it that there isn't a national debate about our priorities? Because this is just an extraordinary amount of money, and it comes at the expense of other needs which are being neglected.
Well, it certainly is an extraordinary amount of money. You know, in the past, although Pentagon spending has been high, there have been ups and downs. But during the century, other than a small dip after the passage of the Budget Control Act in 2010-2011, it's been onward and upward. You know, we're spending more than we spent at the height of Vietnam or the Reagan buildup or Korea. And as you said, there's not really challenges out there to justify that kind of spending. So I think one element is it's just been taken for granted. It's sort of like the weather, gas taxes. It's just, of course, it's always going to go up. I think part of it is the military-industrial complex and arms lobby, which compromises a lot of members, Democrat and Republican, about when and whether they might challenge a given weapon system. I think there's still kind of a notion on the Democratic side they don't want to be seen as soft on defense, soft on terrorism, despite the disastrous results of the so-called war on terror and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, it's almost like Washington and a lot of the press corps that covers Washington are operating in a parallel universe. And as you said, there's evidence that the people who fought the wars are starting to realize that this money has not been well spent. So, it's still, even given all those factors, it's still surprising, I think, that there's not more discussion. And, of course, there's no real debate in between Congress and the president. You know, the Pentagon put forward 750, House leadership says 733. That's barely a 2% difference, and a lot of that is the fight over the wall because Trump wants to fund the wall out of the Pentagon budget. So, you know, partly it's just an abdication of responsibility to, you know, be steward of the taxpayer money, given all the other needs that we have.
Well, this the 733, of course, passed the House, which is controlled by the Democrats. And the arguments were largely about the conditions that the Democrats are putting on Trump in terms of starting a war with Iran. He's more or less got to get their permission. That's completely unlikely and a non-starter. The Republicans are basically, the vote was down on party lines. Liz Cheney basically complained, when Congress politicizes the National Defense Authorization Act, we are not worthy of the men and women who are defending us on the front lines. Well, as I mentioned in the opening, the Pew Research have found that the men and women who fought in Afghanistan and Iraq think it's been a complete waste of time and lives and treasure. So much for her argument. What's going to happen, though, when with the Senate? Because this has to be reconciled. So the Senate will probably go for a higher number and try and strip out these Democratic amendments, including one by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez about forbidding any of the money being spent on the southern border.
Well, you know, the Senate will probably come in pushing for the Pentagon's number of 750. And so, you know, the best, you know, quote-unquote best outcome is probably the House number of $733 billion, and probably it'll fall somewhere in between. You know, the only issue where, you know, perhaps both houses might agree is on stopping U.S. support for the war in Yemen. But, of course, then you would need to overcome a Trump veto. And that situation's so horrendous, and the murder of Jamal Khashoggi so outrageous that even people like Lindsey Graham are, you know, opposed to the administration's position. You know, but on most other things, it's going to be tough for, you know, the House to uphold some of the, you know, positive positions that they managed to push through. But well worth the fight, of course.
Well, the military-industrial complex, the amazing thing is that apparently you just can give them a blank check and we don't have to have enemies anymore. We don't have to win wars. And they build weapons that cost a lot. You know, you'd be better off with a Timex instead of the Rolex that they build. And there's a real question of whether any of this stuff works, in particular stealth. I mean, during the Battle of Britain, the British had long-wave radar that was the first use of radar in war, and that, you know, they were able to detect all the German planes coming in. That radar, that same radar today, the Russians have. Anybody can have it, frankly, and it picks up stealth. I mean, how did the Iranians shoot down that drone? It's supposed to be a stealth surveillance platform. So it doesn't seem to matter. I mean, remember when the top secret drone drifted off into Iran and it was apparently hacked by the Chinese or the Iranians or whatever? They got that whole technology. And apparently it had the most advanced radar that, you know how radar works is when you turn on your radar, it's like turning on a flashlight in the dark. It actually pinpoints where you are. And that's always been the problem with radar. But they apparently have developed a radar where you can use it, but it doesn't detect where you are. So they've got all that stuff. And what I find extraordinary is nothing's ever said about this, you know. There's no retribution. They just go on and say, oh, well, we're going to have to spend a few more $1 billion to make up for them, what they've stolen from us or what we've handed to them because of our incompetence.
There's a sort of a hardy band who've sort of tried to raise this issue. People like Winslow Wheeler, who used to be in Congress, Pierre Spray, former weapons designer, Chuck Spinney, the Pentagon dissident for many years, the Project on Government Oversight, a handful of members of Congress, but not enough to really turn the tide. I mean, you know, the F-35, which is, if they continue, will be the most expensive weapons program ever that the Pentagon has funded, is not ready for prime time. I mean, it can't really do well in a dogfight. It's not particularly good in supporting troops on the ground because it's trying to do all things to all people. It actually carries less a load of munitions than current generation. And it's got stealth, which, as you said, is by no means, where it's been advertised to be. So, but on the other hand, Lockheed Martin has tried to put it in as many states and districts as possible. The Air Force is very attached to it. The new head of the Army even used to work for Lockheed Martin on the F-35 program. So it's got its, you know, supporters sprinkled throughout the government. And it stands in the way of just, you know, whether you're a hawk, a dove, whatever. I mean, why should there be a constituency for building weapons that aren't relevant or don't work is a bit of a mystery.
But the drone, the Global Hawk drone that was shot down by the Iranians, cost $123 million each, and that's $34 million more than the Lockheed Martin's F-35. I mean, and by the way, there's a replacement drone, a new generation, that is called the Triton that's being deployed. So, you know, those costs seem to have gone under the radar altogether. Not, you know, all of this drone stuff.
Yeah, the theory was drones were going to be substantially cheaper. You weren't going to put pilots at risk. They were going to be more discriminate, and the chances of killing civilians would be less. And they've met, you know, none of those objectives because, of course, the corporations in the Pentagon can't resist making things more complicated, more expensive. And so you've got drones being built now that are 3, 4, 5 times what some of the originals were. Of course, the way they've been used has caused substantial civilian casualties, much more than the Pentagon's willing to admit. And they're in many ways more vulnerable because they're just kind of hovering up there. They don't really have the speed and maneuverability to avoid, in some cases, being shot down. So it's another one of those, you know, they call it the revolution in military affairs, how these new technologies are going to revolutionize warfare, give the United States this unbeatable edge over other countries. And under minimal scrutiny, those arguments fall apart.
And again, I'm speaking with William Hartung, who's director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. And his latest book is Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. We're talking about the House passage of a defense bill for $733 billion. And the Senate is likely to ask for more. It's the $750 billion that the Pentagon is asking for. So why is the Pentagon asking for so much money? I mean, normally the military-industrial complex, and by the way, you know, Milton Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's brother, I talked to the him and a long time ago, obviously, he wrote the military-industrial complex farewell address where Eisenhower first coined the phrase military-industrial complex. They originally had in the draft of the farewell address, or Ike's farewell address, it was the military-industrial congressional complex, and they decided to take that out in deference to the Congress. But the Congress usually asks for more, and the Pentagon usually asks for less. Or at least they say, we don't want what you're asking for. I mean, how many C-130s have we built? I mean, it's insane how they waste money because of the pork barrel in various districts where important members are. Why this time is the Pentagon asking for more money? What is their excuse if they need one?
Well, their new National Defense Strategy and this National Defense Strategy Commission that Congress appointed, which was riddled with executives and others with ties to the weapons industry, are basically shifting away from using the fight against terrorism as their rationale, I think partly because it's been so ineffectual and disastrous in many ways. So now it's about great power rivalry, China and Russia. And now they point to things like Russia's actions in Syria and Ukraine. China's, although spending much less than the United States, has been growing at a faster rate and has its regional interests in the South China Sea and so forth. But as you suggested, none of those things are going to be ingredients for any kind of major great power war. For example, with China, even if they were to fight, which would be disastrous because it's two nuclear armed powers, they're not going to be shipping tanks over there, and yet Trump is giving speeches at the tank plant in Lima, Ohio, about how many more he's going to build. The Army itself wanted to stop. They had 6,000. They couldn't know what to do with them. They were putting some of them in, storage, basically. But the Ohio delegation, Republican and Democrat, helped sort of keep that plant open, and then Trump opened the floodgates, spending more, and of course they've sold some to Saudi Arabia, which has kept the plant going. So, they always look for a new enemy to justify their spending. And, at the end of the Cold War, Colin Powell famously said, I'm running out of enemies here. Then they built up Iraq and North Korea as kind of the regional challenges that justified keeping the Pentagon budget much higher than it would or should have been, even with the disappearance of the Cold War adversary. So, it's kind of standard practice, but I think, there's not a lot of knowledge base about Russia and China. I think it lets them get away with quite a bit in that regard. And just in general, playing on fear has a long history of success in our politics.
Well, William Hartung, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His latest book is Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how Jeffrey Epstein is Donald Trump's idea of the perfect man.
Well, he says he's got a big boat with a high roof.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lucian Truscott IV, a journalist and author of 5 best-selling novels. He's a graduate of West Point and is currently a regular columnist for Salon, where his latest article is Jeffrey Epstein is Donald Trump's idea of the perfect man. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lucian Truscott IV.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I must say that let me just read the beginning of your article, because I think it really nails the discussion that I want to have with you. He owned a palatial home in Palm Beach and a luxurious residence in Manhattan. He owned a commercial airliner converted into a luxurious private plane. He gave parties attended by young women seeking careers in the modeling business. He was connected to numerous wealthy, powerful men who shared his taste in women and money. He bragged to others about his sexual conquests with women. He paid women for sex. He was charged in lawsuits with numerous sexual assaults on women. Is that Jeffrey Epstein? No, it's Donald Trump. So how do you think, you know, the person who broke this story at the journalist at the Miami Herald, she recently said that a lot of powerful, rich and powerful men are sweating at the moment as these revelations about Epstein come out. Following his arrest and the police breaking into his home, or the FBI breaking into his home, do you think Donald Trump is sweating?
I think so. I don't. I mean, there seems to be some, if not evidence, allegations that he participated with Epstein in some of his parties and that sort of thing. There's a story out about a party that Trump gave, well, not a party, but a gathering of between Trump and Epstein and something like 24 young women at Mar-a-Lago, I think in 1994, that hasn't been denied or refuted. So it sounds like Trump had some connections with Epstein, and although we don't know whether the 24 young women were underage or of legal age, but Trump certainly had a reputation for in New York for chasing women, and of course there's been 24 women that have charged him with groping or sexual harassment or some other sort of sexual, you know, assaults, grabbing under the table, grabbing, you know, he grabbed one woman on an airplane who was just sitting, happened to be sitting next to him. So, you know, the thing that that amazes me about this whole story is that it seems that wealthy men, whether they're billionaires or not, and it appears that either Trump or Epstein are really billionaires, but they've got this hideous predilection for abusing women, and they go to great lengths to arrange all kinds of ways, you know, for them to get away with it. I mean, it looks like Epstein bought an island in the Virgin Islands to have a kind of, you know, anything goes getaway that he could use, you know, to lure young women there and have, you know, underage women and have sex with them. I don't have an answer for what wealth and this obscene kind of privilege does to these guys, that so many of them seem to have this you know, this flaw, but it really seems to run with the along with having money and being in this world of, you know, Manhattan and Palm Beach and luxury estates and so forth.
Well, when you say he's had these sexual assaults, this long list of women, but both Trump and Epstein have also, and particularly Epstein, he preys upon girls, young girls.
Yes, he does.
Not
yes.
women. And apparently Trump also has that predilection. The biographer at Bloomberg, Tim O'Neill, had actually went with Trump when he purchased the Young Miss America contest or whatever it's called, Miss Teen America. I'm not sure what the title of it is. But he was apparently, going into the dressing rooms and these half-dressed girls and kissing them and touching them up, et cetera. And he loved it. And that seems to be the MO of these guys. It's hardly a coincidence that they're all in some way or other, they have modeling agencies, or they have, in the case of Epstein's business partner, he owns Victoria's Secret. We know that they have lots of models. It seems to be a kind of sort of underground service that they provide for, wealthy men who, as you say, on the island, anything goes. Apparently anything goes at the properties in Palm Beach, in Manhattan, and in New Mexico as well.
Yeah, it's really, it's just stunning, and it's the thing that I found remarkable was, with all of these stories about Epstein, that the stories about Trump seem to be going down the memory hole. I mean, this, in the story that I wrote, I quoted, I went back and got out the so-called Excess Hollywood tape and quoted the bloody Excess Hollywood tape, and it's just horrible. He said something like, I went after her very strongly. I went after her like a bitch. And all of this kind of stuff. I mean, it's, I said in the article, who talks that way? Who uses those kinds of words, and who brags that way about assaulting women and going after women? And it turns out that it's the guy that we now have as the president of the United States. And I think with all of this emphasis on Epstein, we're losing track of the fact that Epstein is maybe a sexual predator, and in fact, he's convicted of it. But we have a sexual predator in the White House. Trump has been charged by multiple women with sexual abuse, and now with E. Jean Carroll with raping her. And I don't care what Trump says about, well, she's not my type, or I certainly wouldn't have done that, or, the excuses he comes up with. At the time of the Excess Hollywood tape, when he talked about pursuing this woman and taking her furniture shopping, his excuse was, I've never taken a woman furniture shopping. I mean, these things are silly. Mm-hmm. But his excuses are silly.
Well, but
to get away with them.
The excuse that she's not my type indicates that if she were his type, he would have raped her. So it's amazing that the American public somehow just, I don't know what, I think, let me just again remind the audience, I'm speaking with Lucian Truscott, the fourth, a journalist and author of 5 best-selling novels. He's a graduate of West Point and is currently a regular columnist at Salon, where his latest article is Jeffrey Epstein is Donald Trump's idea of the perfect man. I'm beginning to think, Lucian Truscott, that we as a nation are all rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, that we have no idea, simply can't face the reality of who this nation's leader is. He's a traitor, a criminal, and a sexual predator, if not a pedophile. And it's extraordinary. And the Russians helped him last time. There's growing evidence now that the Russians had a relationship. with Epstein. He's the perfect vehicle for compromat. I mean, you couldn't ask for more. If you owned that guy, you got, you know, the dirt on what Bill Clinton was up to, what Prince Andrew, you name it. We've got the Democrats arguing amongst themselves over whether to impeach or not to impeach. You've got this crowded field where you can't figure out who the hell's worth listening to in these debates. And nobody's really looking into what is going to happen in 2020, where, you know, the Russians are determined to reelect this guy. And they'll spend what they have to do. They'll meddle in whatever polling station they have to. And, you know, we're just, as I say, as a nation, we're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic and arguing about all kinds of extraneous stuff and not looking at this shameful situation we have with not just this terrible person in the White House, but he was put there by a malign foreign power who's going to guarantee that he gets reelected. I mean, how stupid are we?
Well, I think we're pretty stupid, and I don't think that we're ignoring it, but certainly you and I aren't, but there's a significant portion of the public that is ignoring what's going on. The idea that the so-called religious right could vote for this guy, and the cognitive dissonance that's involved in these people having these so-called religious convictions and ending up endorsing this the behavior of someone as corrupt and as much of a sexual predator and abuser as Donald Trump is just absolutely stunning and jaw-dropping. You know, I wake up every day and I wonder, you know, what's the next revelation going to be? What's the next horror? I mean, today there was Trump coming out and saying a couple of these female Congress person should, you know, sort of love it or leave it, go back to the countries they came from, and that sort of language. I mean, we haven't heard that sort of disgusting talk since the Vietnam years, since the Nixon years. The idea that, you know, that if you don't support the president somehow, you should leave the country. I mean, these things are obscene and insane. And yet we find ourselves, you know, with 40% of the public, not only putting up with it, but endorsing it and voting for it and being happy about it. I mean, I think the amazing thing about Trump is that he's shown the American people the soft white underbelly of this country, how much of this country is overtly and even proudly racist, and how much of this country is misogynistic and willing to put up with sexual abuse and sexual harassment and even rape in the people that they support for public office. I mean, this has been here all the time, but I don't think that until Trump came along, he sort of took the lid off of the Pandora's box and exposed it. But now here we are, and I just, you know, I hope, as you do, that the Democrats get out of their typical circular firing squad and start thinking about, you know, who we're going to vote for to get this guy out.
Well, I think you have to also add to that, because so many people live vicariously via television and social media, that Donald Trump is uniquely positioned as a reality TV star to manipulate them on a daily basis. His is a presidency of government by stunt. Everything is a reality TV, phony cliffhanger. He zigzags, he's on and off. It's all about grabbing the headlines to what's happening today. Even though people are wringing their hands about this cruel idea of rounding up people that's sort of reminiscent of the SS, it's a phony deal. He's already signaled to tell people they're about to be, you know, if you're going to round up people, you don't advertise that the ICE is coming. It doesn't matter to him what's going on. It only matters to him that he grabs the headlines. And what I find incredibly frustrating is that the press, of which I guess I'm a member, you know, are just being whipsawed and manipulated every day covering this guy. And it's all to his benefit. He grabs the headlines, and we gave him $6 billion of free advertising to get him elected in the first place, and we're still doing it.
Yeah, I think one of the things the press could do is stop covering the guy when he's leaving the White House to go get on his bloody helicopter. I mean, he stands out there on that lawn, and he uses the opportunity of all these White House press corps stenographers running up to him to just stand there and lie. And they're running cameras and microphones and asking these silly questions and just taking in the lies and distributing the lies. I mean, if nobody showed up for him to get on the helicopter, he wouldn't be able to stand there and lie. And, you know, that gets me too. I mean, I don't know what the solution is because the one thing that Trump has said that's probably true is that the newspapers and cable television networks and so forth have made enormous quantities of money off of him, covering him, and because of that they won't stop. You know, they just continue to do it, and the Democrats have got to get rid of this 20-person melee they've got going on and get it down to a couple of people that the media can cover in some sort of rational and reasonable way to disseminate the positions and ideas that the Democrats are going to run on against him, because he disseminates his lies every single day with tweets and little stupid press conferences at his desk and standing out there on the lawn. And meanwhile, all these candidates are running around and you hardly see anything about it.
Right. Well, on top of that, you've got Jerry Nadler and Adam Schiff fighting over to impeach or not to impeach. Schiff wants to be the hero who brings the case via the Intelligence Committee and doesn't want to impeach. And Nadler wants to move on with it. And Nancy Pelosi is caught in the middle. And AOC is calling her, or her staff are calling her a racist. And as you mentioned, Trump's turning around and using racist insults clearly against the congresswoman from Minnesota, saying, you know, she should sort of get out of the country. So it is really sad that we have this level, this paucity in the loyal opposition. And now because they're squabbling over how much time they want to grandstand with Mueller, they've had to delay this Mueller investigation for a week, or his testimony. And if, you know, Trump believes in the deep state, or says he does, and some his followers do, if Robert Mueller is the best that the deep state can hand up, then we're totally screwed. I mean, I wish there was a deep state that could get rid of this guy, but unfortunately it doesn't exist.
No, Mueller is just an establishmentarian. That's all. And he's not only that, he's a Republican establishmentarian. I mean, you know, these guys are, you know, sit there in Washington and run in and out of government and you know, and Barr is another one. You know, he runs over and makes a few million at Kirkland and Ellis, and then runs over the Justice Department and does the bidding of idiots like Trump or idiots like Bush. And then they run back over to places like Kirkland and Ellis and load up on cash again. I mean, you know, The way politics is run in this country is disgusting. I mean, there was a story out the other day that said that since Biden has left the presidency, he's made something like $15 million. You know, that's 2 years ago. Who makes $15 million in 2 years? You know, the way that they grease the skids for these guys and pay them money, you know, just load their pockets. And I don't care if they're Republicans or Democrats. It's just disgusting because guys like Mueller end up owing the people that line their pockets. And Biden, I don't know who's lined his pockets, but somebody did, and the guy ends up owing them. If Biden would ever get to be president, he'd owe the people that gave him $15 million over 2 years. I mean, it's just amazing. It's amazing. This system has been in existence for decades, but the racism thing, the way that that's bubbled out to the surface is really just jaw-dropping.
Well, and then the other story, of course, just in closing, is that how the big society people in New York rehabilitated this guy after the scandal broke in it down in Florida. He'd have regular dinner parties where he'd invite Prince Andrew and all kinds of people would show up on a regular basis, including Woody Allen and Charlie Rose. You'd think those guys, given the accusations against them, wouldn't be so brazen. But what a world. What a country.
I lived in New York, and I saw him cozying up to Roy Cohn back in the 70s.
Oh, Lord.
You know? Yeah, I mean, that sort of thing, cozying up to these kind of creeps in Manhattan, the rich people doing that, has been going on forever.
Well, Lucian Truscott, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Lucian Truscott IV, who's a journalist and author of 5 best-selling novels, a graduate of West Point. He's currently a regular columnist at Full Salon, where his latest article is Jeffrey Epstein is Donald Trump's idea of the perfect man. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into whether the delivery of Russian missiles systems to Turkey, which the U.S. has warned is a deal breaker, will in fact end Turkey's participation in the F-35 program or possibly NATO itself. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amit Yella, who is a professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. He formerly served as professor and as a chair of the Sociology Department at Harran University in Turkey and was also a counterterrorism police chief in Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amit Yella.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Amit. And what's going on with Erdogan in the sense that he is obviously in complicity with Putin? We know Putin is very clever at driving a wedge between the U.S. and the Western Europeans, and he's done very successfully, particularly in, say, a country like Austria. He's had a lot of influence there, which is pretty extraordinary. the idea that he's able to drive a wedge between NATO's two biggest armies, the United States and Turkey, that's not bad, is it? I mean, so why is Erdogan helping him?
So it is really bad, and we need to understand there is a big shift in Turkey's international politics with Erdogan. Today, Erdogan had a press conference in Turkey in Istanbul, and I am going to quote him as I start my interview. He literally said the following today: regardless of Turkey's political military alliances with the West, we continue to receive the biggest threats from the West, be political, economic, cultural, or by all other means. So for Erdogan, the West has been a considerable enemy, and his rhetoric, particularly after 2014, and especially focusing on the United States, has been towards this path. His media, and he controls almost all the major media outlets in Turkey, has been pumping anti-West and anti-American rhetoric for the last at least 3 or 4 years. So this is not a surprise from Erdogan's perspective.
So what is his motive? Is it because he and his family are, stealing the country blind, getting rid of the intellectuals, rolling back the secular tradition? Is this because he's angry that the West is calling him out on who he really is? Or is he genuinely? Does he genuinely believe that the West is an enemy? In other words, for example, when the terrible incident happened in New Zealand with that horrible massacre, he brought up, the idea that he attacked the New Zealanders of all people, and then showed that horrible video that nobody would show. At rallies to rile people up against the idea that somehow the West is against Islam. So what's his game here? Is it genuine, or is it because he's a crook and he doesn't like being exposed as a crook?
I think number two, we need to understand Erdogan's mindset. When he was caught red-handed at the end of 2013, when the Istanbul Police Department carried out the corruption operations against Erdogan's close family members and Reza Zarrab, who was working on behalf of Iran to launder Iranian oil money with the exchange of gold. His corruption scheme was revealed, and he really got angry. And he believes that behind that scheme was the United States, and in fact, a year later, the FBI opened a similar investigation in New York, and Reza Zarrab, the middleman between Iran and Erdogan, was arrested by the FBI in Miami. So Erdogan was extremely upset for the FBI revealing his corruption. And that investigation was in trial in New York Federal Court. And the deputy chief of the deputy CEO of Halk Bank, a state bank in Turkey, was sentenced for I think around 2 years of prison time because of his role in that scheme. For Erdogan, it is a matter of staying in power and being out of prison because of his corruption, but at the same time, there has been issues regarding the regional conflicts. For example, Turkey has closed its eyes and allowed ISIS to freely pass its borders and allowed all those foreign fighters to join ISIS without any hindrance up until 2016. So Erdogan has this understanding that he needs to be in power regardless of what. And for that, he has been driving his supporters, at least half of the country, away from the West and pumping a rhetoric through the media, which he controls, unfortunately, almost all of the media in Turkey, including CNN Turk, which is also tied to the CNN International here in the United States. That rhetoric actually helped him. So his followers believe that the United States and the Americans and mostly the West are the enemies of the Turkish people. And they are fighting against Erdogan because he represents, according to them, the real Islam. And he is like an Islamic leader in the Middle East. Therefore, the West does not like him.
And again, I'm speaking with Amit Yella, who is a professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. He formerly served as a professor and the chair of the Sociology Department at Harran University in Turkey and was a counterterrorism police chief in Turkey. So how is this working, though, with Turkey's historical animus towards Russia? In other words, are Erdogan's followers able to overlook history and basically now decide that Russia is their friend and America is their enemy?
So I think there are like different historical incidents that everybody can refer to talk about these issues. For Erdogan, when he's speaking about the West, he reminds people the First World War, how the Ottoman Empire collapsed at the hands of the British and the French, and how the United States is working with the British and the other Western alliance. And therefore, there is like a reminding behind his rhetoric that the West was originally our enemy. And if you remember, Erdogan is historically pro-Ottoman, and he refers to the Ottoman Empire and the times of Ottoman Empire very frequently. And he considers himself, or his followers consider him, as the neo-Ottoman Sultan. Therefore, it is very easy for him to portray the West as his enemy. After the coup attempt in 2016, his media openly wrote that the United States was behind the coup. And there were a lot of like very thick and radical rhetoric against the United States. They named people. They opened investigations against American bureaucrats, including the chief of military, the chief of staff, the director of the CIA, and others. So, yes, we had, as in the past, Turkey had problems with the Russians, but I think when he speaks about those historical facts, he can very easily portray what happened during the First World War and then, you know, pump a rhetoric against the West very easily. So, yes, people are forgetting the issues, the historical issues with Russia that the Ottomans and the previous Turkish administrations experienced.
Well, there's some suspicions now that the whole coup attempt was in many ways, Erdogan knew about it and was able to found out about it through loyal officers, I guess, and sort of let it all happen in order to become this great martyr. Because there's no way in the world, all of his emergency powers came out of this failed coup. The failed coup in 2016 was the greatest gift that Erdogan could possibly have had. And is there anything to these suspicions now that maybe either Erdogan or his friends or his supporters in the military knew about it and let it happen?
I think there is enough evidence to prove that Erdogan knew about the coup. And in fact, he said the coup was a gift from the gods to him, so that he could assume all the powers he needed. Otherwise, he wouldn't be able to get. And the coup helped him a lot to grab all those powers he wanted to have, which he wouldn't be able to get through the democracy or democratic means. He knew about the coup. His chief of staff, Hulusi Akar, knew about the coup. And in fact, when we listen to the generals who spoke up during the trials, they said Hulusi Akar was basically leader of the coup attempt, and they were played by the director of the MIT Turkish National Intelligence and the chief of staff. So it was very obvious through the evidence we have today that Erdogan and his people knew about the coup, and they used that coup instead of preventing the coup to bolster their own powers, which worked for him very well. And I think what we need to understand here, Erdogan cut an alliance with the Yuria Ejnalist just before the coup, at the end of 2014, when he realized his reign was in jeopardy because of the corruption operations, he made a new alliance with the leftist nationalists in Turkey, which represented historically the ultra-secular military and judiciary in Turkey. There are two important groups in Turkey. One is Doğu Perinçek group, which is called also Aydınlık group, and the other is Oda TV group, who are ultra-secularist, leftist, and at the same time nationalist. But historically, they were against Erdogan. All of a sudden, in 2014, they became very close because Erdogan needed new allies to survive. And they helped him to survive through those hard days. And I think they were also part of the staged coup in terms of helping Erdogan and also themselves to survive in the future.
Well, they're going to regret it. I mean, the only good news is that he lost the elections in Istanbul. So there are indications that at least what's left of the opposition is trying to fight back. But he has so much in common with Trump, it's amazing that somehow...
Yes, Erdogan believes that even though the American government or like the Congress is against him, he right. believes that President Trump is going to save him, and he's not going to apply the sanctions Congress is asking.
Right.
Somehow, he believes that he is going to be immune from the sanctions the American Congress is trying to apply against.
Right, and they're going to happen next week after the anniversary of the coup is over. I thank you for joining us here today. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ahmet Yeler, who's a professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and a fellow at the Program on Extremism at George Washington University. He formerly served as professor and the chair of the Sociology Department at Harran University in Turkey and was a counterterrorism police chief in Turkey. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, assistant producer Kathleen Ash. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can bookmark it, sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy this program, make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And be sure to share the program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And if you are in a position to support us so that we can sustain and build this program, visit us at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Your support will help spread the word and keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent. And we'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loves.